Turn in your Bibles to the book of Esther. I don't recall that I have ever preached over one or two sermons from this book in my life, but for the next few weeks I'm planning on preaching quite a few, because we're going to look at it verse by verse all the way to the end. I read almost the entire book last night, and I was just thrilled with a lot of the things that I saw in this book. And so I don't recall that I've ever even attempted to make an effort to teach it. But I am going to do so in the next few weeks here on Wednesday night. There's a lot that could be said, both pro and con, concerning the book of Esther. There are a lot of people that don't even believe that it ought to be in the canon of Scripture. And we'll talk about that some later. But I want to give you tonight, first of all, some introductory remarks concerning this book of Esther. I would point out that it is one of the few books in the Bible that is named after a woman. Esther was a woman. You have the book of Ruth, and you have at least one lady addressed in one of the epistles of the New Testament. But overall, there are not a great number of books in the Bible that bear the name of a woman. But this particular book does. Now, the book was named after the principal character in it, who happens to be Esther, the lady that is so many times spoken of in these chapters to follow. Now, that was not her Hebrew name. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, which means myrtle. I suppose it meant the myrtle tree. It just means myrtle in the Hebrew. But in this book, she is given the name of Esther, which is a Persian word. And after all, what would you expect? Since she is living in the country of Persia, she becomes the queen of Persia. And no doubt, she was probably even born there in that land. She has therefore been taking this name that is Persian, Esther. So she was known by that Persian name. The Jews would call this book the Roll of Esther, or sometimes they would merely just say the Roll, and it was understood to be referring to the book of Esther. The book of Esther gives the origin and foundation of the Jewish Feast of Purim, and it's still celebrated until this day. That feast commemorates the deliverance of the Jews from Haman, who sought their destruction during the time of King Xerxes of Persia. Now, as to the date of the writing of this book, it is most uncertain. It was probably around 464 to 434 B.C., and we cannot be any more specific than just in that general radius there. It would seem from the opening sentence, as well as the conclusion of the book, that it was written after the time of Xerxes, the king of Persia. Now, that being the case, it is more than likely that it was written during the time of Artaxerxes Longimanus, about the time, right after the time of Xerxes is what we're saying, sometime right after the time of the reign of King Xerxes. Another remarkable feature about this book is that it covers only a very brief space of time. You may remember that when we taught the book of Genesis, I told you that that thing covered better than 1,000 years. But now, the remarkable thing about this book is that it covers the period of time from the third year of King Ahasuerus of Persia until the 12th year of his reign. And you can see that by looking in chapter 1 and verse 3, and then in chapter 3 and verse 7. So you're talking about a period there of just a few years at best. And so it does not cover a great deal of time. It covers a very brief space of time. And most of the events in the book happen during one of the years. That's under consideration, if I remember. There have always been critics of the book of Esther. And for instance, Martin Luther was one of those critics. He said that the book of Esther and the book of James ought to be taken out of the canon. And the reasons that he gave in the case of both made very little sense to me. And I never really had a lot of respect for Luther anyway. And after he denied that these two books were canonical and taught a lot of other heresies, I had even less respect for him. I'll just put it that way. Now, some of the objections that are raised concerning this book being a part of the canon and the fact that they say that it ought not to be in there is, first of all, the fact that the name of God nowhere appears in the entire book. You won't find the term Lord, the term God, at all referred to in this book. And then there are others that say that the principal characters in the book are all worldly people, like Esther the Queen and King Ahasuerus and Mordecai, who was a rather prominent man at different times. So they say there's no real spirituality in the book. But I totally disagree with all of these objections, and I would give at least a few reasons why. First of all, let me point out that some of the saints in the Bible are not always saintly people. And if you doubt what I'm saying, you might consider the story of Lot and David and Samson, and on I can go. So you see, there's no need for the name of God to be in the book in the absolute sense. We don't need to write on this building that it's made out of blocks. Anybody that has one eye and half sense that has ever seen it knows that it's made out of blocks. People that live in a brick house do not find it necessary to put up a sign outside, "This is a brick house." Because everybody that's got any sense knows that it's a brick house. Well, the Lord didn't need to put his name in the book because his finger of providence is on every page and in every verse. And we'll demonstrate that as we go through the book. So God's name is not found in it, but his hand of providence is everywhere visible. I believe that if I were to give this book a name, I would call it the book of God's divine providence. You ought to read one of the great sermons of C.H. Spurgeon on providence in the book of Esther. It'll bless your heart. I read it many years ago. The book of Esther has always been a part of the Hebrew scripture. And it always has been read in connection with the Feast of Purim. And so far as the canonical aspect pertaining to the Jews, there's not any doubt in their mind. There never has been any doubt. It certainly is a part of their canon. Because of that, it has always been received by the Christian church as being a canonical book, as being authentic, and deserving a proper place in our Bible. Now, it is probably one of the most purely historical books in all the Bible. And one of the other remarkable features about it is that it's never quoted anywhere in the New Testament. No New Testament writer ever quoted the book of Esther. You say, well, what does that prove? Nothing. Just merely that the Spirit did not move upon them to write concerning any statement in this book. There are other books in the Old Testament that we have very few quotes from, if any, if I remember. So we might ask this question, since we pointed out these unusual features about it. What did God design to teach us in this book? Why was this book written? Well, I've already pointed out that it demonstrates, in my estimation, the providence of God. But I'm going to add a little to that. I'm going to say that it demonstrates God's providential care of his people who did not return unto their own land under the edict of Darius, but stayed in the country where they were captives and where they were born. And needless to say, because they were not in their land, because they were in a strange land, there were always plots against them as a people. And if you'll study the history of the Jewish people, wherever they go into a Gentile country, there is always some sort of conspiracy to either liquidate them or to get them out of the country. And so the scene that is painted here in the book of Esther was painted during the Second World War, during the time of the Holocaust. And it was painted during the time of the Spanish Inquisitions. And it has been painted many times over in the history of the Jewish nation. So actually the book demonstrates the truth of Psalms 37 verses 12 and 13 to me. The wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. And so that's exactly what happens to old Haman in the book of Esther. He plots the destruction of the Hebrew nation, and it ends up that his own destruction comes about instead. And so we'll talk about the practical aspect of that later on in the book. So I think it was designed to show how that God took care of his people, the Jews, even though they were in foreign countries. They had the right to go back to their homeland, but not all of them went back. And here's an account of some that didn't go back. You may wonder what happened to them. Well, here's part of the story about what happened to them when they didn't go back under the edict of Darius. So I've already told you that it gives the origin of the Feast of Purim. That's still an annual feast of the Jewish people, and this book is read during that time, and they tell about this great deliverance, and that's what they celebrate when they have that feast every year. I believe the book also was designed to humble the proud and to exalt the lowly, because that's seen in the case of Haman and Mordecai later. I also believe that it was intended to show how that God saves those people of his that pray to him and trust in him. There are many examples of that to follow. And then if I had the time, and I may not take the time as I go through the book, it's interesting to look at all of these characters that are brought forth from time to time. You can just about find certain types of people like them in the world today. There are some Hamans. There are some Esthers. There are some Mordecais and the like. They're still in the world. And so each of the leading persons in this book presents a separate type of character under the unconscious but overruling providence of God. Men and women are free to act, and they are responsible beings for all of their actions. But behind these lies the purpose of God to manifest himself. And so what we see in this book is God behind the scene, as it were, often manifesting himself, delivering his people, judging their enemies, and taking care of them in whatever state they would find themselves in. Now there's a lot of things that we could say about it, but in my estimation, the book of Esther is a confirmation of Romans 8:28. If there's any book in the Bible that confirms the truth of Romans 8:28, it is the book of Esther. For we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. This book confirms the truth of Romans 8:28. Now, as to who the author was, there is considerable debate and discussion. There are a lot of people, and I suppose if I were to just go around here tonight and say, who wrote the book of Esther? More than likely, I would say, well, Esther did. Just like when you're out to ask who wrote the book of Daniel, well, Daniel did. See, it's just a normal way for us to react and to think. But there is nothing to indicate that Esther wrote this book, so far as I know. So, well, it bears her name. Well, some of the old names given to the book, if you go back into antiquity, was the Book of Mordecai. It wasn't called the Book of Esther always, but it has been called for many years that. Now, there are some that believe that this book was written by the great synagogue that was composed by Ezra the scribe. While there are a lot of people inclined to believe that, especially Jewish commentators, so far as I'm able to ascertain, there is very little evidence to prove that to be the case. I am at least convinced in my own heart that Mordecai was the writer of this book. There are various statements in there that sounds as if he wrote them to me. And after all, he would have had a greater knowledge of all of these events almost than anybody else, unless it would have been Esther the queen. So I'm inclined to the idea that it was Mordecai, or probably someone that was very close to him. So I don't know. We probably never will know in this world just who the human writer of this book was. At least I do not know for certain. The style of the book is somewhat remarkable. It's very chaste and pure in its style. The sentences are very clear and unambiguous. And so it is a good piece of material from the literary standpoint. It has a number of Persian words in it, as we might expect, since it was written by people living in Persia. We would just only assume that a part of those words would creep into the book. You probably have noticed in my preaching here that every once in a while one of our words from way down south creeps into one of my sermons. And every once in a while I could say that about your own section, that I detect certain words that fit right in with your culture, right in with this section of the country. So you have some Chaldean words in the book of Daniel. It ought not to surprise us if we have some Persian words in the book of Esther. As a matter of fact, Esther itself, as I've already pointed out, is a Persian word. Also in this book, in the original, you'll find the later Hebrew form of writing mixed with a certain amount of Chaldee at times. So it would be wrong to say that this book was written in what we'd call the pure Hebrew, for it was not. Now, we don't see that when we look at our English versions, but scholars tell us that have access to some of the older manuscripts of the book and historical knowledge of the background of the book. Well, so much for the introduction. We're going to see life as it was in Persia. Shall we say 500 years before the birth of Christ, or perhaps even a little nearer, probably 450 years before the birth of Christ. I have always admired the Persian people. And you know, the more I read this book, the more admiration I have for them. When you compare the Persians to the Babylonians, there's not much comparison. If you want to see immorality, then go to Babylon. And no wonder that John in the book of Revelation described the apostate system of religion under the figure of Babylon, and the apostate political system under the figure there of Babylon. So I can see why. But never are they called Persia or Persians or anything. The Persians were a people that I greatly admire in history. And I believe as you compare what we have here to follow, that you may admire them also. Now remember that the wise men that came when Jesus was born, in all probability, had came from Persia. I'm convinced that that's the country they came from. And no doubt they had some of that knowledge there that might have even been left to them and passed down from Daniel the prophet. At least I think there's a good possibility that's what it might have been. That's supposition, but anyway, it is my supposition, and I'll let it go at that. Now let's look at chapter 1, and we won't go too far tonight, probably about down to verse 9. And we're going to see a great feast that they had that involved a vast Persian kingdom at this time. And this man that is always called Ahasuerus in our Bible is called in history Xerxes. He was the famous man that is mentioned so many times in connection with the battle of Egypt and the battle against Greece. So we just mentioned that in passing for those of you that may know history. Well, now, in the first 9 verses, we have the feast that was given by the king to his people. And so his vast kingdom is mentioned in verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even to Ethiopia. Now, that's a vast territory. Even today it would be. Over 127 provinces. That was a vast kingdom. And it was known as the kingdom of Persia. And oftentimes was connected with the weaker kingdom of Media, or the Medes, as they were called. I just make one observation from the book of Esther compared with the book of Daniel. If you'll compare that verse with Daniel chapter 6 and verse 1, you'll find that the kingdom of Persia has grown from 120 provinces in the days of Daniel now to 127 provinces. So seven have been added since the days of Daniel in Babylon. So now I tell you again that this Ahasuerus is Xerxes. But do not let that term Ahasuerus throw you. That was a common name of the kings of Persia. A lot of times in history we get a little confused. For instance, in Egypt they were called Ptolemies. There was a big family of them like. They were called Caesars in Rome. And oftentimes the king was called Caesar regardless. And they were called in Egypt the Ptolemies. And in the time of Moses, the king of Egypt was called the Pharaoh. And it didn't make a difference what his name was. He was the mighty Pharaoh. So Ahasuerus is the official name of the kings of Persia. So it didn't matter whether it was Xerxes or somebody else. He still would have been called Ahasuerus. And that's what I want you to remember. And so this Ahasuerus is the one that we know as Xerxes in history. I keep putting that down because I want you to remember that. Well, let's go on and look at the second verse and see what we have. That in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace. Well, something else we note here. He settled on his throne. I would think so. He has, a year before this, just subjugated all the land of Egypt. And now he is plotting and planning the conquest of Greece. And really the meaning of this feast is that it's going to be a military council. And it's going to be a council for war against Greece. And evidently it must have taken them quite a while to plan out the strategy, because it was almost 6 months that this thing went on. So it must have taken them quite a while to debate the tactics of warfare, judging by what follows here. Now his palace is called Shushan. And that was the royal city of the kings of Persia in Nehemiah 1 and 1. Nehemiah said he was in Shushan, the palace of the king. And Daniel, of course, makes mention of Shushan in Daniel 8 and verse 2. So that was the official residence of the king of Persia, called Shushan. Called Shusha, sometimes is the spelling, but called Shushan here in our version. Now, when we get to the third verse, we find out about the feast and those that are in attendance at the feast. In the third year of his reign. So now that lets you know when this chapter was being written, or at least the chapter, the period of time that's under consideration. It was written after his reign, but it's written concerning those events in the third year. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. The power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. So it was a great gathering there of all the political figures of all the provinces. No doubt all the military generals and like were present there, because he was contemplating an expedition against Greece. And you know that's exactly what Daniel the prophet said he would do. I can't help but point out that this is a fulfillment of the prophecy of the Bible. Go over there to the book of Daniel, the 11th chapter. And Daniel makes it just about as plain here as it could be that the king of Persia, or kings of Persia, would attack Greece. And incidentally, Xerxes didn't do very well in that battle. He lost it. He was defeated. Now look in Daniel 11 and 2, and it's dealing here with Darius the Mede. But anyway, he goes on to talk about the kings of Persia there in verse 2. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. And the fourth shall be far richer than they all. You'll observe here in Esther chapter 1 that Xerxes is showing the riches of his kingdom. Think about this statement here. He shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the rim of Grecia. And so actually there, what you have in this chapter is a fulfillment of Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2. And Xerxes is doing what Daniel the prophet, some maybe 75 or 100 years before, had said would take place. So fulfilled prophecy proves the Bible. And here's another example of that. And I thought we ought to notice that in passing. Now, there's some interesting things about the ladies later here. We want to get to that as soon as we can. Now, look in verse 4, how that he's a show-off. Is it not true that oftentimes great political leaders are show-offs? But what's sad is sometimes some of God's own people are. As a matter of fact, some of us sometimes are not much better than this king, because we like to show off what we got, too. It's human nature to be that way. And so while he's actually saying that he's going to show the riches of his kingdom, he's really going to show his power and his pride, if you want to know the truth about it. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days, 180 days, that's roughly speaking about a 6-month feast. Now, I've seen people show off for an hour, maybe two, but for a man to put on a show for 180 days is quite a monument to human pride, in my estimation. So this king was a very proud man. He had a lot of stuff evidently to be proud of, and he didn't mind showing it off. And after all, he wanted to impress all of these people, because if he could impress them with all of his wealth, they might be more inclined to go off and fight against the Greeks. And so that's probably what he had in mind doing there. Now, after the time of this 180-day feast, or during the last 7 days, scholars can't agree as to maybe just exactly what the idea was, but I'm inclined to think that it was 7 days after the 180 days, which makes a 180-day feast because of the statement there in verse 5. And when these days were expired, and I assume that means that 180 days, or the 180 days, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan, the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So now what you have here, strictly speaking, is two feasts. You have a 180-day feast for all the big dignitaries of the kingdom, the governors of the province, the military generals and the like. And then you have a 7-day feast for the common people that were present there in Shushan, the palace, and probably the dignitaries all gathered there in the palace, whereas the common people had to meet out in what we call the courtyard or the gardens. Evidently, that was a very beautiful place from what follows here, because go on and look at that 6th verse there. Where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen, and purple to silver rings and pillows of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. Quite a rainbow when you think about it. Must have been a very beautiful place to look at. We think sometimes today we've got beautiful structures, and perhaps we do. But let me tell you what, in the ancient world they had some also. Think about the Great Pyramid. Man till this day has never built anything to come up with that. And they're still trying to figure out how the thing was built. How a structure that size could be built back in that day and be perfectly balanced all over at the same time. And a part of it, of course, pointing right straight to the North Star, showing that they had some knowledge of astronomy back in that time. So there was a beautiful structure here. And as you might expect, at these great feasts, there were a lot of people that were going to drink wine. And that was a social custom of that day, and I'm sorry to say that our modern world has not progressed much beyond that. Because every time you see these politicians on the TV or see a picture of them in the newspaper, they're still doing pretty well what was going on here. They're still drinking the wine or the liquor and the like. But anyway, this king was a little tolerant with his liquor. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another. And that sounds to me like that when they drink out of one of them, they'd move that one out and they'd bring in one that looked different from that, all of them being made out of gold. That's quite a scene for a 180-day feast to go on like that. And raw wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. So if a fellow wanted to drink wine out of a golden goblet, he wouldn't have had any trouble in that day. There were plenty of them available. And some historical records say that 15,000 dignitaries were here at this feast alone. I don't know. I know that there were many people that could have met there in the palace of Shushan from what I read about it. Sometimes Jewish history is correct, and again, it's in error. And right here's one time that it blundered. The Jewish Targum says that the vessels of gold that they drink out of were the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of Jerusalem during the time of his invasion. But the Jewish Targum is wrong because the Bible contradicts that. In the book of Ezra, chapter 1, verse 7 to 10, and incidentally, the book of Ezra was written before the book of Esther, as far as the timetable. It said that Cyrus, the king of Persia, gave to Zerubbabel all of these vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem. So these vessels were not in Shushan at this time. They were in Jerusalem. So far as I know, that's where they were for quite some time. So the Jewish Targum is just simply in error on that historical statement. It is just not according to the facts of the Bible. Now let's go on and note the law about drinking. I suppose there were some fellows back in that day that were teetotalers. And evidently some of them were there at that feast, and so the king, wanting all the help that he could get to go against the Grecians, he didn't want to offend anybody, so he said, you can have a little drink if you want it, or if you're a teetotaler, you don't have to take a drink. And that's essentially what he said. Now look at that eighth verse. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel. Now you say, well, why did he put a statement like that in there? Well, you don't understand the custom of the people of that day. If you went to a feast of the king or even to another dignitary and you didn't drink wine, you either got kicked out the door or they poured it on top of your head. It was considered an insult to the host. And so it was just a custom. But here, for no doubt political reasons, the rule was suspended, at least temporarily. A man could be a teetotaler, and if that was the case, then he didn't have to drink any of the king's wine, the king wouldn't be offended. That's more or less what we're told. I tell you what, that kind of shames a lot of our professed Christians who think they just have to have a drink, you know, in these big social meetings. Just got to have a little shot. Well, even this heathen king that didn't know anything about the God of the Bible, he had enough sense to say that if my political friends want to drink or don't want to drink, it's their business. But you know, I don't know that we've ever had many presidents in this country that didn't drink on social occasions. And I have seen the liquor bill of the White House sometime, and I wondered how the taxpayers was able to bear the burden. And so this king maybe had more sense than a lot of our modern day politicians. Because none did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of the house, of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. I suppose if you didn't want to drink wine, maybe they had grape juice for all I know, or maybe they had something else. Maybe they had a tea of some kind. Anyway, you didn't have to drink the king's wine unless you wanted to. There's a warning in the Bible about putting up a cup of wine to your neighbor and making him drunk. And this king, while he didn't know the Bible, he was, in a sense, carrying out the scriptures. Well, I may not take the time to read it. Then again, maybe I will. In the book of Habakkuk, chapter 2, and verse 15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunk also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. You know, it's a funny thing about an old drunk. He likes to take his clothes off. You ever watch that? The Bible's true. The Bible's true. The symptoms are not new. And then what else does it go on to say? Look at the symptoms of drinking again in verse 16. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of things there associated with liquor that's still going on today, just like it was then. The world really hasn't changed very much. People still are inclined to do just like they did in the days of Habakkuk, just like they did in the days of Esther the Queen. Now, for just a few moments, we're going to look at this woman, Vashti, who evidently was the first woman that Xerxes ever married and probably may have been the only legal wife that he ever had. I'm not too sure about Esther. I'm afraid the history is not too favorable on that. But anyway, I don't know. I'm not going to say. It tells us this much about Vashti. And later on, down in verse 11, it said that she was known for beauty, that she was fair to look upon. So she must have been a very beautiful woman. Actually, the word Vashti means beautiful. That's what the word means. So if you want to give your daughter a good name, I suppose that'd probably be a good name, come to think about it. I've never known over one or two people in my lifetime that had that name. I know a church that bears that name down in Virginia. But anyway, it is a good name. However, it may not be as good as you think at first. Brother John Gill points out that the word Vashti is also Vashti. Got a T-A there instead of the T-I and all of that on it. And it says that the word means vehement fire. And so it was associated with one of the deities of ancient Persia. In other words, an idol god. So she really was named after an idol god of Persia. So maybe it's not such a good name, see, after all. I don't know why that the word meant vehement fire. I can only just imagine what that might have been. Anyway, we go on quickly to finish up here. Also, Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And so one of the remarkable things is that the women here are in separate quarters from that of the men. See, the Persians had at least some sort of moral standard. They didn't have the men and the women out there on the dance floor. They were in separate chambers. There was not a lot of illicit sex going on because there were no women present there where all the generals and the statesmen were. But now, what was it like in Babylon? You can go to Daniel 5 and 2 and you'll find that the wives and the concubines and all of them were there and they're all getting drunk together. See, Persia had a pretty good moral standard. That's what I want you to see there. Now, a lot of people say, well, who was Vashti? I don't know, and probably will never know. Some have speculated and said that she was the daughter of Cyrus the Great. She may have been, I don't know. Other scholars say that she was the daughter of evil Merodach, who was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know. She may have been. All I can say is that her identity was not known in the time that I can find any information on. There's just no real proof who she was, other than she's the wife of King Xerxes, and that's all I can tell you. So we'll stop there for this time and continue the chapter. You'll find out that this lady, Vashti, evidently had heard of the women's liberation movement in the next part, and she got into a lot of trouble by going along with it, too. As a matter of fact, the old king kicked her out as a queen. So it's not a good recommendation for the women's lib movement, I'm afraid, come to think of it. Let us stand. We'll have our closing prayer.